From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I think that people have an idea about feminists, which is, you know, that stereotype of the man-hating, child-hating, hairy-legged, Birkenstock-wearing person who is very humorless and very politically correct.
Celebrated feminist writer Katha Pollitt. According to a recent study, both men and women hold negative views of feminists. But, as it happens, having a feminist partner is linked with healthier, more romantic heterosexual relationships. And feminism could use some good news, especially after 9/11 energized old frontier myths about tough men and weak women.
You know, it was the myth that was lying on the ground that got reactivated that we just instinctively grabbed for.
Journalist and feminist Susan Faludi. This hour, feminists keep the faith and look forward. We'll hear from the first African woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And a fan finds feminist rebellion in the torch song tradition.
It costs me life, but there's one thing that I've got. It's my man. It's my man.
Katha Pollitt is one of America's best-known feminist voices. She's known for her cultural commentary and her hard-hitting column in The Nation magazine. Recently, Pollitt turned heads with an unexpectedly revealing account of her personal life and musings about the relationship between men and women and women's friendships. Pollitt read Anne Strainchamp some of her essay Learning to Drive from her book of the same name.
Over there, the red Jeep. Park. Ben, my gentle Filipino driving instructor, has suddenly become severe, abrupt, commanding. A slight man, he now looms bulkily in his seat. His usually soft voice has acquired a threatening edge. In a scene that we have repeated dozens of times and that has kinky overtones I don't even want to think about, he is pretending to be the test examiner, barking out orders as we tool along the streets above Columbia University in the early morning. I am impersonating the would-be licensee, obediently carrying out instructions. Pull out when you are ready. Right turn. Left turn at the intersection. Straight. All right, Ms. Pollitt. Pull over. He doesn't even need to say the words. From the rueful look on his once again kindly face, I know that I have failed. What did I do wrong this time? Did I run a red light, miss a stop sign, fail to notice one of the many bicyclists who sneak into my blind spot whenever I go into reverse? Observation, Kata, observation, this is your weakness. This truth hangs in the air like mystical advice from an Asian sage in a martial arts movie. That and lining up too far away when you go to park. The clock on the dashboard reads 7:47. We will role-play the test repeatedly during my two-hour lesson. I will fail every time. He was a genius, a pedagogical genius, this man.
The driving lessons are the framework for another story, the story of your betrayal by your boyfriend, partner of some 7 years. What happened?
Well, it's really a story about observation, that you can be the smartest person in the world, you can be very clever, you can be a very good analyst of the larger world. But when it comes to your own life, you make the same kind of clueless mistakes that we all do in our life. My story of, you know, being in love with someone who was also carrying on with other people, unbeknownst to me, is the commonest story in the world. It's so common. Nonetheless, when this book came out, I think some people were shocked that I talked about this, that it was, you know, if you're a feminist. To a lot of people, feminist is sort of like, it's a synonym for brick wall of solid, humorless rectitude, you know? And then when it turns out that you have some of the same problems that, in fact, all of the same problems that everybody has in some form or another, some people were quite shocked and they didn't like that. And I'm thinking, people were very critical, even that I didn't know how to drive. Can you believe that? And I'm thinking, well, I can do other things.
It's a book written by a woman who is the best known feminist writer in the country. And you're revealing something devastating that happened to you in the way in which you were tricked by a man and betrayed. And that's, I mean, you know, you read it and you sort of think, my God, if this could happen to Katha Pollitt, you know, what hope do the rest of us have?
Well, you've given me a big upgrade in my career. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. But, you know, if you look at, just for a minute, let's talk about the real great feminists of history. Mary Wollstonecraft, Simone de Beauvoir, Betty Friedan. They all had very big, stressful, complicated, stormy romantic lives. It was not simple for them, and it's not simple for anybody. We have this idea, which is related, I think, to kind of our stupid celebrity culture, where, you know, there are these people out there, they're supposed to have it all figured out. And of course, they never do, because life is very, very hard to figure out, and also because you are you. So you are always seeing life through this scrim of your own fears, desires, hopes, history, and all the rest of it. So
there's also a weird way in which, I mean, within feminism, we're now on what, third wave, fourth wave? I can't keep track of the waves. But daughters are perennially, you know, famously very hard on their mothers.
It's
so
true.
I think that feminist daughters have looked to our mothers to say Simone de Beauvoir, who let herself be treated terribly by Sartre, and we've said, well, that was her failing. You know, we know better. So I think, I wonder if that's part of the reaction to the story you tell.
That's part of it. But the other way of looking at Simone de Beauvoir's life is Simone de Beauvoir got to be a great writer. And that was why she was here on Earth. She was not here on Earth to, you know, have a happy marriage, you know, and have, you know, three children and be a solid, upstanding member of Parisian community. She was put here to be a much more interesting person. And so she made more dangerous choices. But I wanted to say another thing, which is that I think that people have an idea about feminists, which is something a little severe, invulnerable, you know, that stereotype of the man-hating, child-hating, hairy-legged, Birkenstock-wearing person who is very humorless and very politically correct. I think that this book, you know, really doesn't fit that stereotype at all. But what has struck me is that there are little tiny pieces of that stereotype that are true and that have come out in some people's response to the book, which is, we cannot let people know that we are vulnerable. Mm-hmm. We cannot let people know, for instance, that we really do care if we have a boyfriend, you know, if we are heterosexual. And if we're not heterosexual, we care if we really have a girlfriend. And, you know, the thing is, when feminism restarted, at the end of the 60s and the early 70s, women talked to each other. They talked to each other about their personal lives and their private lives. And they learned a lot from each other because everybody was feeling, oh, my God, I'm really lonely in my marriage. My husband is violent. My kids don't respect me. I'm having a terrible time at work because, you know, I can't get promoted because I'm a woman and everybody treats me so badly. But everybody thought they were the only one. And that everybody else had it figured out. And it was this conversation, you know, whether you call it consciousness raising or just a new frankness among women about everything from sex to work to parents to clothes to how they felt about their looks. It was unbelievably enlightening. And I feel we need to get back to a little bit more of that. And I think
we've also created a brand of feminism, as you write about, in which it's the you go girl feminism. You know, the idea that you don't criticize another woman for what she does and that whatever she wants to do, whether it's get breast enhancements or walk around, you know, in incredibly revealing clothes or have serial relationships, that it's all, what do you say, she's captain of her soul, I think you write. So you're not supposed to criticize another woman. But is that feminism or not?
Well, I think one way of seeing feminism that allows people the individual freedom that everybody wants is to see it as a social justice movement and to see it as a movement about equality for women and social respect for women, and women having the ability to make the life choices they want to. We don't have that now because women get very little support from society. And we're never going to have a society in which everybody is very buttoned down. And, you know, there are always going to be girls who want to wear, you know, that porn star T-shirt, and maybe they're wearing it just to try it on. Maybe they're wearing it because they feel sexy. Maybe they're wearing it to make fun of the idea of porn stars. I mean, these things all have a lot of different meanings. But what I do notice is that young girls, for example, in a way that was not true when I was growing up, are targeted by advertisers, the fashion industry, and the media from the moment they're born. And this is very hard for them to negotiate, to feel that in addition to everything else, you have to be hot 24/7. That's the real job that society makes you do. And then they're all monitoring each other's weight in this way that is, you just want to say, here's where I think feminism really could do something. Just lay off each other. Girls, lay off each other. Because, you know, you asked a question as if, you know, there's too much approval among women for each other's choices. In fact, there's very little approval. Mm. When people say this go girl thing, they're saying that because they feel very defensive. They're making a choice that probably may not be a very healthy choice, and they don't want to be criticized for it.
Mm-hmm. In one of the essays, Sisterhood, I think it's called, you write quite a bit about the bonds between women, and you set out to talk with a bunch of the women your ex had slept with while he was still with you. These are women who, many of them were friends or acquaintances of yours, who knowingly betrayed you.
Well, no, I wouldn't put it that way. No, I wouldn't put it quite so harshly. They were very kind and told me everything. that was good. That was good. But, you know, in that essay, Sisterhood, I'm looking at, and that title is a little ironic, but also a little not. I'm looking at, there's a quality, talking of the you go girl Oprah culture, there's a quality where women can bond around their weakness. They bond in the following way. Women, we're so warm, we're so caring, we're so sharing, we're so great, we have so much to give, we just want to love. In fact, you know, I just can't help myself. I just feel such attachment to people. And yet there are men, they're so cold and heartless, they're rats, you know. And one of the reviewers didn't understand that when I said men are rats, that was indirect discourse. Mm-hmm. I was making fun of that perspective. That is not my actual view. But I do think that there is a way in which women give themselves credit for something that they maybe could toughen up a little bit about, that actually it's not good to be endlessly giving and endlessly understanding of someone who is essentially a narcissist or someone who is essentially not going to do that to you. And you see this all the time. You see this in women's magazines. One of the major projects of women's magazines is to explain to women why it doesn't matter that their husband is inexpressive. You know, mm-hmm. He forgot your birthday. But that doesn't matter. He changed the oil in your car. Mm-hmm. You know, there is so much of this. And you just want to say, well, maybe it does matter if he forgot your birthday. Maybe that is kind of a message, you know. Maybe you should try forgetting his birthday and see what happens.
Katha Pollitt is a columnist for The Nation magazine and the author of Learning to Drive. Anne Strainsham spoke with her. Coming up, hearing rebellion in the torch song tradition.
I want to hear her saying, wait just a minute. I'm not quite so taken with this fella. I do care, and I'm not going to put up with it, at least not always.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. After the terror of September 11th, America wasn't sure how to react. Gradually, we heard about a return to traditional values, nesting, comfort food. But how true was that story? Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and feminist Susan Faludi isn't buying it. She writes about the effect of 9/11 on society, especially women, in the book The Terror Dream. And she says the American reaction to 9/11 wasn't what you'd expect.
We were saying it changed everything, and yet we were frantically going in the other direction. What set me out to working on the book was just seeing in the days and weeks and months and then years afterward this strange response. I mean, we fell into this odd kind of fever dream where our political leaders were reenacting some old drama and the Wild West drama and the old frontier, and our media and pundits were talking about how this was going to be the return of a John Wayne manhood and the return of a kind of Doris Day femininity, with women supposedly going back to the home in reaction to the attacks. And none of this seemed to be a response to the actual threat we faced. I mean, we've been attacked by hijackers who aimed their planes at the symbols of commercial and military power in this country. I mean, they weren't attacking the home and hearth, so why were we reacting that way?
Let's talk about some of the things then, and whether they are real or not. I mean, some of them I don't suppose you can track. There's no way you're going to know whether mac and cheese really became the American foodstuff again after this. Although it makes sense, you know, you want comfort food when you're frightened.
Right. The media had a series of stories about how we were going to be stocking up on roasting pans and kind of Susie Homemaker, you know, sewing machines. And the roasting pan prediction may have come true simply because it was some weeks before Thanksgiving. But that really had nothing to do with how women were responding to an attack in New York. To understand it, you have to understand where this mythology that we live by comes from. And the mythology is of a sort of masculine nation that protects its women. And you see that in the, you know, everything from the Daniel Boone story to Last of the Mohicans down to the modern era of John Wayne movies to the very post 9/11 informed film War of the Worlds, the Steven Spielberg film, in which, you know, you have the dad played by Tom Cruise rescuing his daughter, not only from Martian attack, but from some sexual predator in a kind of farm homestead. We have a almost, you know, a reflexive reaction, which you saw front and center after 9/11. And my question was, well, where does that come from in our history?
It's a story we like to tell. It's a story that seems to provide some comfort.
And comfort is the key word. And the question is, well, what's underneath it? And as much as we heard over and over in the media after 9/11 that these sort of attacks were something that had never happened to us before, you know, that America is not a nation that's vulnerable to assault on home soil, and certainly in the modern era, that's largely true. But if you go back and look at our earliest foundational historical experience, you see a very different tale.
In what way?
Well, for the first two centuries of, you know, early American colonial American life, over and over again, the experience of that period, the sort of central experience, was being attacked on quote-unquote home soil. Now, clearly, this is home soil that that the settlers took the info away from the Indians.
Yeah.
But viewing history from the perspective of the settlers, if you view it from the Native American experience, it's a completely different drama, but that's a story for another day. The settlers experienced being attacked by people they regarded and demonized as non-Christian, non-white, quote-unquote terrorists. That was a term that was, in fact, used. And these were attacks on villages, communities. They were aimed at the home and hearth. Moreover, they were attacks in which, time and again, leaders, militias, husbands were not able to protect their families. People were taken captive. Women were taken captive, and women, time and again, defended themselves or denounced the male leadership for not, you know, for failing to protect their communities. This was not a story that shone a very, you know, rosy light on the notion of male protection. So starting in the 18th century and culminating in the Victorian era, what you saw was a sort of systemic cultural rewrite where journalists, novelists, artists, sculptors took these accounts and revised them till male shame had been turned into an exaggerated ironclad male valor, and female strength was either, you know, derided or turned into exaggerated helplessness.
Okay, all of this begins to make sense, but didn't we move past that? Isn't that a story that belongs to the Victorian age and earlier? Haven't we, in the last century, granted women more and more respectability, responsibility, strength in American society? Why would 9/11 cause us to go to a Victorian model?
Well, as much as we like to pat ourselves on the back and think that's all ancient history, the history of feminism in America is, you know, 5 minutes of hooray for women's independence followed by, you know, years on end of hysterical counter-reaction to that. I mean, going back to the Victorian era, that last half of the 19th century was a period where women were working very hard to expand educational and economic opportunities for themselves and push for suffrage. And what you saw was an enormous counterattack to that, and in sort of burrowing into that mythology. And in the 20th century, again, you saw that after suffrage was won in 1920 and, of course, in the 1950s. And then in our earliest, most recent period, you know, we had the 70s as a moment when hooray for the second wave of feminism, followed by, you know, the immediate clampdown by the end of the 70s, and certainly with the dawn of the Reagan era, you know, a full-blown attack. And the attack took the form of, no, 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 women want to go back to the home. Women don't want these high-pressure jobs. Women fear that if, and rightly so, that if they get education, they'll reduce their chances of marriage. So, you know, by, yes, the introduction of feminism, but at the same time, a desperate holding on to that mythology by both men and women.
Why do you think we were so quick to adopt this idea as a nation? You can understand how some might cynically say this is an opportunity to push certain ideas on the country, but as a nation, we bought it.
Well, this goes back to, I believe, and I'm not offering this as the only reason, but I think a profound aspect was this experience of 9/11 as an almost a throwback to our original trauma. And by that, I don't mean, I'm not talking about some sort of recovered memory syndrome on a cultural level, but by going through a trauma, much like the original crisis we experienced in the early days of American experience, we reached out for that same mythology that had been our kind of protective security blanket that we spent all those years creating to sort of paper over our original vulnerability. So it was, you know, it was the myth that was lying on the ground that got reactivated that we just instinctively grabbed for.
Maybe we need to look at history again and see what the reaction of the American public was to similar events 2 centuries ago or 3, because one of the things that's fascinating about this is to realize that while America was under attack, as it was in the ways that you've described, the response of the founding fathers was to not limit liberties, but to demand
expand them. Exactly. I mean, here's a generation steeped in the very trauma that created this mythology down the road. But at the time, they embraced and elaborated on a social vision of democratic principles, of tolerance, of liberty. It is possible to go in another direction. I would point to our mobilization to World War II as an alternative vision, where we had a leadership that appealed to our hopes, not our fears, that concentrated on a practical, pragmatic response that engaged and required sacrifice from everyone, that brought women into the workforce, not sent them home to bake cookies, that subsidized daycare during the war so that women were able to work and have children, and that concentrated on actually achieving our aims, you know, producing liberty ships at a what seems now like a miraculous rate, and well-built ships. You know, we contrast that with our inability even to provide armor to our soldiers in Iraq.
These are hopeful images from the past. For the feminist movement, are there hopeful images to go forward with? What does it mean for feminism today to have had this response to 9/11? Where is the movement going from here?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think what we need the resurrection of a movement. And by that, I mean, of course, there are women out there who've been activists, who've been working so hard all of these years and have not given up. But in order for the country as a whole to move forward towards real equality, towards engaging the entire population in public life and in public responsibility, we need a movement that has a broad base. We need to return to the idea of that feminism is about remaking society in a meaningful and imaginative and bold way.
Susan Faludi is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of The Terror Dream.
Take this pink ribbon off my eyes. I'm exposed and it's no big surprise. Don't you think I know exactly where I stand? This world is forcing me to hold your hand. Cause I'm just a girl, a little lonely. Well, don't let me out of your sight. Oh, I'm just a girl, already a fugitive. So don't let me have any rights.
Stacey Holman-Jones is a sucker for a good torch song. As a self-proclaimed feminist, she adores the music but has a harder time with the words. So she decided to dig a little deeper. In her book called Torch Singing, Holman-Jones finds evidence for empowering messages of desire and resistance in some of the most lovelorn songs.
I've loved these songs for a long time, and actually it was kind of a curious fascination for a while. And one day I thought, what's a good feminist like me listening to all these doormat love songs? Probably like any young person who discovers Billie Holiday in the bargain bin at the record store, I just was so taken with her voice, and I really love those old songs of hers.
It's a funny thing, isn't it? I suspect, I don't know whether this is true for you or not, but I think it was for me. You listen to them and enjoy them before you hear what they're about.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then, lo and behold, one day you start really honing in on the lyrics, and then there's that moment when you have to say, wait a minute,
right.
Did she really just say that?
I'm curious, I guess, how you as a feminist scholar can listen to these songs about women who are not being treated well and who don't seem to care.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was really my main question. Once I had that moment when I really listened to the lyrics, I thought, well, I can't listen to these songs and be a good feminist. And then, you know, but I couldn't give them up either. And so I started to think pretty hard about why that might be. And it occurred to me, and I think the listening can bear this out, that taking the lyrics just at face value is a mistake. I think that there's a good deal of cautioning, a good deal of irony sometimes that inheres in the performances. And if you really listen, I think that there's a lot going on under the surface of things that casts doubt on those lyrics.
Mm. Well, let's talk about some of the songs then, because maybe you can help me understand that. How about My Man? It seems to me that's right. A classic song that if you listen to the lyrics, this woman, she's being treated badly and she knows it, and it makes no difference whatsoever.
Right. I mean, she says, I don't care.
Right.
And that's really the signature torch song. You know, the lyrics, you know, he isn't good, he isn't true, he beats me too, what can I do? I mean, those are not, that's not a positive message.
Yeah, it's pretty extreme.
Anybody. Yeah, yeah. And so when you listen to someone like Holiday sing it, there's a reserve she brings to that song and her performance of it that opens up a lot of space for interpretation, I think. And I want to hear her saying, wait just a minute, I'm not quite so taken with this fella. I do care, and I'm not going to put up with it, at least not always.
It costs me life, but there's one thing that I've got, it's my man, it's my man. Cold or wet, tired you bet, all of this I'll soon forget with my man.
So when you listen to Billie Holiday sing My Man, you hear something other than the lyrics that are there. You hear her almost saying, yeah, go ahead, listen to what I'm saying, but you know I'm smarter than that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's there in the recording. And if you think about the circumstance, this is the kind of material that was popular, that she was asked to sing, and certainly wasn't something to be refused if she wanted to have a singing career. And so she was very crafty, I believe, in giving an alternative interpretation of these lyrics that she was singing.
He beats me too, what can I do? Oh, my man, I love him so.
On the other hand, we look at what we know of her life, and she had problems with drugs, she had problems with men. It's not unreasonable to listen to the lyrics of that song and say that could be sung straight from the heart.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I guess I don't want to suggest that it was always a rejection of the lyrics. Certainly there's some truth there. I want to be cautious when thinking that even if she's offering me, listening now so many years later, and all the women that were in the audience or listening to her recordings, some alternative or at least a questioning performance, I don't want to believe that she couldn't take her own advice, at least in moments. That's not to say that she certainly didn't have failed love affairs or that she didn't trust men who weren't good to her, but I don't think that captures the entirety of her life.
Well, let's talk a little bit about a contemporary singer. There's Katie Lang's Save Me, which is it's a contemporary song, I think probably qualifies as a torch song. Do you think so?
I think so, yeah. Particularly because it's on that kind of crossover album that she did, Ingenue, and those are all, for me, that's a very torchy album. All the songs there are very emotionally charged, and certainly there's some unrequited love going on there for sure.
Yeah. Well, knowing her biography, you come to the song with a little bit of difference. I mean, she is a strong woman who is active in gay rights. She's been out as a lesbian for a number of years now. Do you hear her politics when you listen to Save Me?
I mean, I think it's hard to come to the listening without being aware of the politic. At the same time, I don't want to listen to that as only political, as only coming from that kind of political place. And so that's kind of moving from the opposite direction of someone like Holiday, and there's a lot more subtlety, I think, than just the politic in someone like Katie Lang's music.
Save me. Save me from you. But pave me the way. Thank you.
I listen to Katie Lang sing, and she seems so strong to me that save me doesn't seem like a plea so much as a statement, I guess. It's different from a torch song traditionally.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think that has a lot to do with the singer. And I also think it has a lot to do with the performance of that song. I think that as hypnotic as that particular number is, there's not an invitation to get lost in that desire to be saved. There is an assertion there. I think I hear it too.
The classic torch song singer, in a way, Edith Piaf.
Yes. Now,
she's another woman who had a lot of trouble in her life. And I suppose that makes it, you can't help but hear that when you hear her sing. Do you think of her as a torch singer?
I do. And the material's a bit different, of course. But the thing about Piaf singing for me is that where some other singers might want to kind of maintain a difference or a distance between themselves and the lyrics or themselves and the audience, Piaf just threw herself into those lyrics and into her performances in a way that made her embodiment of those songs, you know, a reality. And so there's a difference there for me. But she's so strong in those performances that, again, I don't think kind of a simple listening really does it justice.
I have a terrible confession to make. I've listened to La Vie en Rose I don't know how many times over the years, and I know that that phrase means life in pink. I don't know the lyrics very well. What exactly is La Vie en Rose about?
Well, it's a love song. I mean, she says she wants to turn everyday words into love songs. And so it's really, and I think of this as true for a lot of Piaf songs, it's kind of a hopeful song about what might be. So when he takes me into his arms, the world is bright. It is a happy vision of life when you are in love.
Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours.
There's a hint of roughness in her voice that makes you perhaps feel that she could have been badly treated, that gives you that sense of honesty in a torch song. And yet her most famous song, La Vie en Rose, that's not an unhappy song.
Oh, no. It's certainly a wanting to be happy song, if not a happy song. And there is that edge, there is that sadness in her voice, there is a bodiness as well. And the thing that I hear in her voice, and certainly was confirmed for me when I was in Paris and I was talking about Piaf, I heard a great story about Piaf, a man who met her when he was a very young man. His parents took him to see her in her later years, and they actually took him backstage to meet her. And he said, when I saw her, she looked like the cleaning lady. And he just wasn't impressed with her at all. And she looked at him and she said, you come back and see me after the show. And after he heard her sing, he said, I was just so mesmerized by her. I was in love with her. And when he went backstage after the concert, he came in the door and she turned to look at him and said, how do you like me now? She really was a master at creating a feeling and an emotional pulse to those songs that, you know, it couldn't have been pure luck. And it wasn't that she was being handed good material. She was really in control of those performances.
Stacey Holman Jones teaches at the University of South Florida, and she's the author of the book Torch Singing. Coming up, we'll talk with the first African woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize, Wangari Maathai. It's to the best of our knowledge. From PRI, Public Radio International. Wangari Maathai has been first at a lot of things. She was the first woman in Central Africa to hold a PhD, and the first woman head of a university department in Kenya, and, of course, the first African woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. In her memoir, Unbowed, Maathai writes about her rise as an activist. In Kenya, 1977, she founded the Greenbelt Movement, which is responsible for planting more than 10 million trees to provide firewood and combat soil erosion. The project was carried out primarily by women. She was elected to Parliament in 2002, where she still serves. Maathai told Steve Paulson that her success in life began with her mother, who chose to give her an education. And later, she continued her studies in the United States.
I always tell people now, students, especially when I meet people who are trying to come to the United States, and I say that, you know, United States is an amazing country. It's one place which really sets you free. It's a country that helps you to think independently, helps you to discover yourself. But it's also a society where you can get lost because there are so many distractions. And so you have a pendulum, and it is up to you whether you want to go to the extreme goodness and realize almost what they call the American dream, or you want to go to the rock bottom. And both are available in this great country.
Hmm. Now, you went to college in the United States. You went back to Nairobi. You got a doctorate there. But didn't you have all kinds of trouble then getting a teaching job at the University of Nairobi?
Yes, I did. And that was my first encounter with the tribalism and sexism, because I know I did not get that job because I was a woman, first and foremost, and secondly, because I belonged to a different tribe or community as the person who had offered me a job. Yet, he had offered me a job. He had written me a letter. I had received it while I was still at the University of Pittsburgh, and I actually missed the graduation ceremony because he had given me a date to report, and I was taking him so seriously that I made sure I was there on the Monday morning that he had asked me to report for duty.
So you showed up and you discovered that there was no job waiting for you?
Absolutely amazing. I couldn't believe what he was telling me. But that taught me a lesson about discrimination, in my own country based on gender and tribalism.
So did that experience start to turn you into an activist?
That experience actually taught me a lot, because for the first time I realized that, yes, the sky is not quite the limit. Some people will put limits elsewhere. And so I started working with the staff union, along with a friend, a woman friend, who was also a member of the academic staff. And we started agitating so that female members of staff could also get the same kind of terms of service as men. And we eventually succeeded, and it was the beginning, really, of what became an engaging life where I was constantly challenging the status quo.
When did you become an environmental activist?
Well, this actually started in early 1970s, and it is very interesting. I write in the book how I was invited by a group of people, mostly from America, Europe, and Asia, who had attended the very first United Nations meeting on the environment in Stockholm in 1972. And these young people came to Nairobi because the United Nations had decided to headquarter UNEP in Africa and in Nairobi. So they decided they would follow, they would establish an institution in Nairobi that would monitor what UNEP would be doing. But because they were all from elsewhere, they came up with this very bright idea that they wanted some local people who would be like a day-to-day board of the institution that they were establishing. So they called us local board or alternative board. And we were in contact with them all the time, but we managed the day-to-day running of the organization. And that's how I got drafted.
Hmm. And why did you start planting trees around Kenya a few years later?
Well, there were actually several points from which this inspiration came. But one of them is the United Nations Conference on Women. I remember listening to the women from the countryside, and they brought in a completely different dimension. They were talking about the felt needs of rural women. They said their issues was clean drinking water. They needed clean drinking water. They needed adequate nutritious food. They needed an income, and they also needed wood fuel, especially firewood. And for me, it struck a bell, partly because I grew up in the same countryside that they were describing. And during my childhood, I was living in a place which was so rich. Water was very clean. The rivers were clean. They were full of fish. And there was woodlots all over. So I used to collect firewood for my mother. So what the countryside they were describing was so different from the countryside that I knew as a child. And that's what one of the major triggers. So I actually asked the women, well, why don't we plant trees? I, of course, was planning for a small project that would coincide with the United Nations Conference on Women. I wasn't counting on spending the rest part of my life planting trees. But that's what I did, because the minute I started with those women, one thing led to another, and then that led to another. And eventually I had a big program that was addressing a lot of issues, many of which had to do with the fact that our environment had been very poorly managed by those in charge.
But one thing that becomes very clear is that some of those things that you mentioned, for instance, clean drinking water, wood to burn, I mean, those would seem to be just very basic resources that everyone would need. But they turned out to be very political because, you know, people are vying for those things. And some people, those in power, don't necessarily want to give those up.
Precisely. You know, these communities, especially in the rural areas, were depending very much on primary resources, on land, on soil, on forests, on rivers. And people in power, and especially at that time in developing countries, they had actually literally abandoned the welfare of their people, and they were very busy enriching themselves, acquiring these primary resources, either selling them or privatizing them. And part of the degradation of the environment was due to this mismanagement and acquisition for personal enrichment. And it was when we discovered that and we started addressing those issues, we started addressing the issues of corruption, and we started addressing the issues of human rights violations and disrespect for the rule of law and complete disregard for the poor, for the majority of the people. That's when we got into trouble. But by that time, I had come to appreciate the fact that if you have a very corrupt government, a very unaccountable government, it's very easy to destroy the environment, and especially the primary resources on which many poor rural populations depend. So instead of dealing just with the benign activity of planting trees, I found myself trying to dislodge those in power from these resources and demanding that these resources be managed properly for the benefit of the common good. And that's what became very political. Eventually, we had a critical mass of people who were demanding that environmental rights are human rights, and we need to have a clean and healthy environment.
There's so much talk these days about Africa in general, and of course, it's dangerous to generalize too much, but I mean, this is the continent that is often viewed as the one with the most difficulties of anywhere in the world. I mean, huge levels of poverty and disease. Are you overall, I mean, are you hopeful about the future of Africa?
Yes, I'm very hopeful. Of course, those of us who went through the independence period, and we are very, very hopeful that we would do better than we were doing under the British and the French and other European powers, have been very disappointed that our leaders let down their people. We also know that to a certain extent they did that because they were supported and encouraged by the superpowers and their allies, and that for a very long period the African people were sacrificed at the altar of the Cold War. But we hope that with the new renewed leadership in Africa, because a lot of the old guards are now being replaced by new leaders, and also I see, for example, in the African Union, that there is really a new desire to manage Africa better, that eventually African leadership will work for Africa and work for the African people and stop being selfish and greedy and corrupt and siphon resources and take those resources to other countries, or even allow their resources to be exploited at their expense. It all has to do with leadership, and that's why I've committed myself so much to governance, because if you have bad governance, it doesn't matter, even if you have a lot of resources. Africa is a very rich continent by comparison. There isn't anything we don't have, but we as Africans have continued to be poor, mostly because we are badly managed. And so the challenge really lies on our leadership to be able to use the resources on the continent for the benefit of the people and learn to govern the people more responsibly and more accountably. So, of course, I do have hope. And of course, I do hope that even the new generation will come again and try again to do the right thing.
Well, I wish you well, and I wish you luck. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Wangari Maathai is the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize recipient. She founded the Green Belt Movement in 1977 and is currently serving in Parliament in Kenya. Her memoir is called Unbowed. Steve Paulson spoke with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Anne Strainchamps, and Doug Gordon. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Kirill Owen is our technical director. You can buy a copy of this program by calling a radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The New Feminism, number 1028B. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.